In the coming week, Iran's Ibrahim Raisi takes office as president, the suspension of the U.S. debt ceiling ends, and the summer wildfire season sets new records. It's July 29th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, in the coming week, Iran's new president, Ibrahim Raisi, is set to take office. After winning 62% of the vote in Iran's presidential election, a race that was widely seen as being designed to favor him, Iran's new conservative hardliner president is ready to assume the country's second highest ranking position. President Raisi will also most likely be slated to be the successor to the country's highest ranking official, the Iranian supreme leader. To start, Bob, tell us more about who President Raisi is and what this change in the presidency means for U.S.-Iranian relations.
Jim, Ibrahim Raisi is 60 years old. He is the head of the country's judiciary until he takes over as president next week. And as you say, he falls firmly into the camp of conservative hardliner. Now, that's sometimes a squishy term as it pertains to Iran, because by many standards, you could take a whole swath of the Iranian leadership and say they fall into that. But Iran has, let's say, Byzantine politics and various power centers in which there are variations in that. For example, the outgoing president, Hassan Rouhani, has been described more as a pragmatist. So still conservative, still hardline in many ways, but pragmatic enough to want to bring the country into the Iran nuclear deal, which is issue number one involving Iran and the United States, I'd say. And that's because he wanted to get the country opened up to outside investment and was willing to talk to leaders of the United States, or have his administration talk to leaders of the United States, to get a deal going. Now, that is going to be the first big issue facing Ibrahim Raisi. He was fairly muted on the campaign trail, if you can call it that, leading up to the elections. But we can be assured by all accounts and by many experts of all stripes that he will be echoing the line of the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, who is basically grudgingly but still behind the negotiation of the nuclear deal. Now, we should note there was just a session in which the Supreme Leader came in and kind of, you know, laid into the United States for all sorts of things, including leaving the nuclear deal under the Trump administration and the way it has gone about, the Biden administration has gone about seeking to negotiate a re-entry into the nuclear deal. So the incoming president, one would think, will be sort of echoing those claims. He has not been as outwardly favorable towards opening up Iran to outside investment as outgoing President Rouhani was as well. And that also plays into this. Our colleague Ray Take has talked about this notion of resistance economy that the Supreme Leader likes to talk about, which is a country more self-sufficient, maybe a smaller cluster of countries it might depend on, than opening itself up to world markets and to entanglements that could hurt it. For example, the U.S. sanctions against Iran right now have really stung the country. So all in all, Jim, we're talking about a much different individual coming into the office of president, very much in lockstep with the Supreme Leader, meaning a more hardline Iran. How that translates into the nuclear deal, which is still being discussed in Vienna, is going to be very closely watched. But the signs are that things could get very hard.
Bob, Raisi is a protege of the Supreme Leader, correct?
That's correct.
Do we have a sense of what the status is on the Supreme Leader's health? Again, I mentioned in the intro that Raisi is seen as a likely candidate to succeed Khamenei when he passes. And there are rumors a couple years ago that he was in ill health, but those health problems seem to have been mediated. So would you have a sense of what's happening on that score?
The sense I have is what has been out in media, and you're right, he has been repeatedly referred to as ailing. And I'm talking about going back 10 years. I believe he has had recurring bouts of prostate cancer, for example, Jim. But also, certainly in the last several months, you have not seen much reporting about or much commenting on his appearance or his capabilities. He is, I believe, at this point in his early 80s. It's also worth noting that he himself was groomed as an eventual supreme leader while he was serving as president of Iran. So this is seen as a kind of a move that's in keeping with what we've seen happen in the past in Iran, Jim. But Khamenei himself, certainly getting no younger. He has been ailing and has reportedly been ailing in the recent history. And one would imagine that whether or not it's a position he holds until he passes away, or whether or not he comes up with some sort of way of passing along power to Mr. Raisi, it's not clear yet. I think, as our colleague Ray Take and other observers have noted, at the very least, this sort of power establishment of Iran right now wanted to give Raisi a chance to show himself in this new prominent position. For someone who is controversial, who's had a controversial past, including a role in condemning to death thousands of dissidents and opposition figures, he has been a kind of a shadowy figure, and and very kind of muted public figure for Iran. So I think the desire is to show him acting presidential, acting as a leader, and then being able to elevate him to this really important supreme leader. I mean, it doesn't get any more supreme than supreme leader in Iran. And I think the goal is to have him show his chops for that.
Well, this issue of the succession for the supreme leader is something to keep an eye on. I don't know whether it's going to happen in the next year, next 10 years, but obviously the actuarial tables point in one direction.
Right.
And the thing is, for people outside Iran, I think even for many Iranians, it's not clear how that succession will work. You had the handover of power from Khomeini to Khamenei. You can see how that worked. But the history of revolutions is the further you get away from that so-called founding generation, the greater the potential for divisions over who represents the true message of the revolution. And so you could have a lot of infighting and backbiting. And we don't have a really good sense of how these choices are made. It's reasonable to assume that there are significant divisions within the Iranian elite. The question is that elite able to find ways to bridge the differences, or do you get splits? And again, history is replete with examples of authoritarian regimes that collapse because their divisions arose over who should succeed.
It's a good point, Jim. And it's also worth pointing out that, you know, Iran has had a number of fairly large public demonstrations, anti-regime, anti-supreme leader demonstrations, we should add, in waves over the past couple of years. There was a very low turnout, I believe historically low in terms of the post-revolutionary Iran for these presidential elections. That was a sort of a vote of protest. And you had recently with shortages, water shortages, and sort of general frustration over the leadership's handling of, you know, all sorts of things, including COVID response and various economic woes. You've had a lot of public disfavor being voiced. There was a crackdown after the latest public demonstrations, and so much so that the Biden administration spoke out against them, further kind of adding to a bit of friction, shall we say, between the two sides, even as they're negotiating a possible renewed nuclear agreement. So Raisi's entering into a country that it's ill at ease. And while there'll be a lot of focus on his comportment and his handling of the U.S. relationship and other international relationships, because that's one of the president's big functions, there is going to be a sense of, you know, what is to come domestically? Is he going to show any sort of softer side to the public? Is he going to crack down further on things relating to internet freedoms and other things that some Iranians have been able to enjoy just a little bit more in recent years?
Well, the supreme leader may take great pride in the resistance economy, but it is clear from those protests you referred to, Bob, that many Iranians are appalled by the resistance economy. So I suspect that President Raisi is likely to be leaning more on the repressive tool than on the opening and reform tool.
Yeah, and you know, we'll have to see to the extent there is also any sort of easing or willingness to compromise on the nuclear front, because there continues to be a lot of language coming out from both sides, the U.S. and Iran, about the extent or the scope of the nuclear deal that shows them very much at cross purposes, Jim. So I don't think we're going to see any sort of rapid move, but it will be very interesting to see if there's any comments by the incoming president in the coming week about the nuclear deal itself.
Well, obviously, with the nuclear deal, each day of delay in getting back to it takes us closer to the end of the deal, which is something that must trouble the Biden administration. But at the same token, we're not far away from the Iranians enriching uranium to the point where effectively the deal is broken. I think that's the challenge the Biden administration faces. And as you point out, everyone's waiting to see what this new presidential leadership will do. There were a lot of negotiations in Geneva, I believe. There was talk that the two sides were close to some kind of deal. Wasn't clear what the details of that deal would be, but everything was put on hold, waiting to see what happens with the Iranian elections and what decisions President Raisi makes. And obviously, those decisions have to be approved by the Supreme Leader.
Yeah, and again, the Supreme Leader has been quite vocal about his disdain for the U.S. approach to talk. So we'll see. But Jim, I wanted to bring us back to the United States, actually, to pursue another development that's going to get a lot more attention in the coming week. There's a looming deadline that Congress faces. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen had warned Congress that the suspension of the nation's debt ceiling ends on August 1st, and that the U.S. economy then faces, quote, irreparable harm, end quote, if lawmakers fail to raise or suspend the borrowing cap before then. Secretary Yellen also noted that COVID-19 has made it difficult for Treasury to predict how long it could delay breaching the debt ceiling. Jim, what's going on here, and are we going to revisit some of these debt ceiling rancor that we've had in the past?
Yes, we are, Bob. We are seeing the return of the debt ceiling games in Washington. For those people who follow these things closely, you might recall that back in 2019, President Trump and the Republican-controlled Congress decided to suspend the debt limit for 2 years. And that's what Secretary Yellen was referring to in her letter to Congress, noting that that suspension comes to an end on Sunday. Let me note that the United States is the only country of any note to have the debt ceiling requirement. Typically, in democracies, what happens is if a parliament or Congress wants to appropriate more money, it is free to do so, and that's the end of it. In the United States, we have this artificial situation in which Congress says, on the one hand, we can't borrow more than this amount, but then goes off and borrows, and then periodically you get to this point where Congress's borrowing bumps up against that debt ceiling, and you get some protracted political grandstanding happening. I think that's what's likely to happen again. People may recall that the last serious confrontation we had between the Democrats and Republicans over the debt ceiling came in 2011 and 2013. It got so bad in 2011 that U.S. sovereign credit rating was downgraded from AAA to AA+. That's the first and only time that the wrangling over the debt ceiling has dented the U.S. sovereign credit rating. Keep in mind, the United States has a long-running reputation for having impeccable credit, and it was downgraded again because of fears that Congress wouldn't do what everybody knew it had to do, which was to lift the debt ceiling. And then most recently, in 2013, there was wrangling over the extraordinary measures that the Treasury Department was using to get around the debt ceiling. And extraordinary measures is a Washington euphemism for accounting tricks used to keep us from hitting the debt ceiling. And again, Secretary Yellen in her letter noted that because of COVID and the difficulty of sort of tracking revenues and expenses, that she wouldn't know for sure when exactly we would hit the debt ceiling. And again, if you hit the debt ceiling, in theory, the government is unable to borrow any more money, then it can't pay its bills, and it is raising the prospect of default. So it is, in fact, a very big deal. And obviously, in this COVID-19 environment, where the government is spending a lot to try to revive the economy to address some very serious problems in our overall social safety net, we are bleeding red ink. And so this is going to be a big problem. And compounding it going into all of this is that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already said that given all the spending that Congress is engaged in, or maybe I should reframe it, he would say, given all of the spending that the Democrats in Congress, along with the Democrat in the White House, are doing, Republicans aren't going to sign up to raising the debt ceiling unless they see very real cuts in spending that can put the United States on a firm footing going forward. Now, the advantage the Democrats have today, unlike Barack Obama a decade ago, is that Democrats control both houses of Congress. Of course, that in some ways is much a curse as a blessing, because as we have seen over the last several weeks, the Democratic control in the Senate is held by the narrowest of margins, which means you have to be able to get every Democrat to go along on what you're going to do. An additional complication right now is we've just reached agreement on this bipartisan infrastructure deal, or I should say the Senate has reached agreement on this bipartisan infrastructure deal. Many progressives in the House, that is progressive Democrats, are very unhappy with it. So the wrangling over that's going to suck up a lot of the political oxygen in Washington. Likewise, Congress is going to go on its summer recess, or excuse me, return to state and district work period early next month. And so the amount of time left to actually tackle this problem is going to shrink. I think everyone's calculations, at the end of the day, both sides will point fingers at each other, try to grandstand, score political points, and that sometime in the November timeframe, they'll come together and strike a deal because they have to, and they've done that in the past. Will that happen this time going forward? I think that's the most likely outcome, but I think this is going to be like a roller coaster, a lot of dips, ups and downs before we get there.
Jim, I've already been holding on to my seat just listening to you map out that. And I'm also thinking back to 10 years ago, which I still very much recall. I think it was actually about this time of year as well when things were coming to a head.
It was.
And it was mortifying, you know, sort of reputationally for the U.S., but it also had impact on the country's ability to make things happen, seemingly. It was damaging in all sorts of ways. And it was not under a COVID period. So as you say, there has already been an enormous amount of money outlaid to relieve all sorts of sectors of the U.S. society. They're trying to forge ahead with what many people agree is a necessary boost to infrastructure. And to have this now, you know, impede on everything else is seemingly the last thing they need, and calls for great gestures, which seem to be lacking right now.
Bob, you raised a very important point. You put your finger on an important lesson for the relevance of the debt ceiling to foreign policy. It's not just that if the United States were to hit the debt ceiling, you wouldn't be able to spend. So that means people in the military wouldn't get their paychecks, defense contractors wouldn't get paid, so on and so forth. But the whole wrangling leading up to it really raises questions about the competence of the U.S. government. Again, go back to the sort of primary mission of the Biden administration is to demonstrate to the rest of the world in foreign policy that America is back and that it is a can-do country that can meet big challenges. And this runs contrary to that narrative. And one of the great attributes the United States had for most of the post-World War II era was that it had this reputation as having a government that could do. After all, it was the government that could put a man on the moon. Now it's a lot harder to make the argument about the competence of the U.S. government. I mean, you had the invasion of Iraq, you had the home mortgage debt crisis in the Great Recession of 2008-2009, the failure to address COVID-19, and this adds up into a narrative that you can be sure the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, and a lot of others are spinning, that the United States simply doesn't have its stuff together.
And in space, at least, we're now seeing billionaires taking the lead on pushing the envelope on what can be accomplished in space, near orbit, and potentially missions to Mars and so forth. So we're certainly in a new era, Jim.
Certainly the case, Bob. And obviously, the Biden administration is hoping to keep these debt games limited, to work out some deal. I think, however, the administration is facing very tough waters on this score, and there's going to have to be a rhythm played out. And unfortunately, the country's reputation is going to take a bit of a bruising until we get to that resolution. But Bob, let's switch and talk about a different issue entirely, which is the immense droughts that are hitting much of the American Southwest. We are witnessing wildfires in California, Colorado, and beyond. The United States overall is facing another climate-induced extreme weather summer. Although the season's peak is yet to come, the sizable droughts and wildfires this summer are characterized by experts as a worrying sign that this could be the worst fire season yet, even worse than the record-breaking destruction we saw just last year. Tell us a bit more, Bob, about how the extreme weather events of 2021 compare to those of 2020 so far.
Sure, Jim. I'll note first that, as we have said before on this podcast and in other discussions, there are wildfires every summer, right? There are wildfires all over the country and in various parts of the world. It's the duration now, it is the intensity, and on top of it all, the extreme heat domes, which we talked about in a podcast just a few weeks ago, that are all driving more pronounced periods and just more incredible fires. So in terms of at this moment, by latest count, there are something like 88 to 90 large fires burning in 13 states. They're mostly in the west of the United States. There have overall been something like 36,000 wildfires that have burned nearly 3 million acres in the U.S. That's an increase from last year at this time. As you say, peak hasn't happened yet by all appearances. And we're also seeing air quality issues that seem to be more intense than previous years. So it's been noted that smoke from the fires I just mentioned have been seen from space, but also the fires, especially the huge one taking place in Oregon, smoke from that fire was said to have influenced what we saw here in the East Coast. Well, I certainly saw at sunset last week, several days in a row, of very hazy, very atmospheric, almost Mars-like sunsets. And that was because of particulate matter, these microscopic pollutants that get in the air, and they pose health risks. And for people who already have issues with their lungs in particular, that's a concern. So added to all the other concerns about what wildfires do in terms of destruction has been the air pollution issue as well, Jim. So there has been an exceptional drought that was forecast early on in the spring. We were hearing about that. There was much less snow, meaning much less snow melt. So there was drought already posing a threat to these Western states. And now the fires are starting to chew across the region, creating a lot of concern.
Bob, do we see any evidence that these fires are changing public opinion on climate change or motivating state and local governments to do more to reduce the emission of heat trapping gases?
It continues to enter more into the conversation. I think you're seeing, from what I've seen in various reports, you'll get officials in states like Montana and other places where they have long been familiar with wildfires, but now it's the intense nature of these that are making them think more and more that this is something that's unusual new normal. To the extent that translates into federal officials from these states actually driving policy, that remains to be seen. It's not clear that's happened yet, Jim. But I think you're seeing in the public opinion surveys I've seen, there seems to be more and more of a cognizance of that. The intense heat domes that I mentioned, I should say also at this moment, there are something like 30 million Americans who are coping with a heat dome that spans across the country. And that's a phenomenon in which you have this sort of high pressure system that just stagnates and sits over a region for intense periods of time, and temperatures far above normal prevail. So those things happening summer after summer, and then in new ways, are driving concern about that. The country, regardless of the lack of consensus still on climate change and human-caused climate change, the country has been moving towards renewables. I think you're going to continue to see that, Jim, although there remain a number of stubborn sort of pockets in favor of the fossil fuel as the sort of priority. But it remains an interesting question, Jim, because how many of these types of summers is it going to take before there is a kind of a change, a wholesale change in climate policy? I think what you're starting to see, at least in the interim, is something we've started to follow a lot more at CFR, which is the kind of resilience aspect and putting into place measures that take stock of the fact that things are happening on the ground. What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do to limit the impact of fire? What are we going to do to sort of direct people in terms of where they're living, and if they're going to live in these fire-prone areas, what they need to do? You know, I've been kind of looking around at various public service announcements you're seeing on websites. It still seems like you're not seeing the mass caution about these wildfires that even you saw in the 70s, I recall growing up, and the smoky bear warnings and things like that. Back in those days were a great concern. They seemed to be everywhere. It seemed to be a really big sort of public service thing that the U.S. Forest Service was involved in. I don't think that's as prevalent yet, or maybe it's just the diffuse nature of way information is disseminated here, Jim, but it's going to require that kind of effort and really ramped up, I think, before the country is able to, one, mitigate the scale of these fires, and then two, go to the deeper causes, which is the emissions that are already influencing climate.
I take your point, Bob, that as a country, we are taking a number of steps to rely more on renewables, rely less on fossil fuels. I don't think we're doing enough. I don't think we're doing it fast enough. And the problem with this issue is that there's so much momentum already built up in the climate system that even if we did everything right from here on out, there's still a lot more damage that's going to be unleashed. And I will note on your resilience point, you're quite right. We're going to have to spend money on things like dealing with the consequences of fires, putting people in places where they're less vulnerable to fires, dealing with rising sea level and the like. But that is going to be hugely expensive. It's going to be bitterly resisted by a lot of people because people don't want to be told you can't live here, even though you or your family have lived here for decades. And the thing is, the argument against doing something about climate change for many years has been it would be too expensive, it would cost jobs. And I think the reality is that dealing with resilience is probably going to be as expensive, if not more.
Yeah. And, the conversation we just had about infrastructure, for example, and the kind of the fraught process that's still playing out on that. There were some elements in the existing package that were to address, energy changes and even some climate issues. They weren't going as far as many in the progressive camp of the Democratic Party wanted to go. And they were going much farther than a number of Republican lawmakers wanted to go. Yeah. And, so that's at the heart of, I think, what you were just saying, Jim, is that we are at a country, despite extreme weather and despite the fact that it is hitting us earlier and then longer, we're still not there. And it's going to take a lot more.
We're being told very loudly, very clearly, we have a problem. And we as a country are not rising up to meet that problem and that challenge.
And we could also cast our look around the world. And I think you do see some countries taking steps, or at least the mitigation steps. For example, it's been pointed out that France was dealing with the intense heat phenomenon back in 2003. It killed thousands of people. It was really awful. They sort of took a nationwide effort to address some of the things that had contributed to the high mortality rate from that period. I'm not sure, except for obviously some of the California communities that have just been absolutely torched. I think beyond some of those immediate places, I'm not sure we're at a national level at all in terms of what we need to do.
Fair point.
Well, Jim, we've talked our way into the audience figure of the week portion of the podcast. Now, listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Jim, our audience selected in a Twitter poll, Tunisian President Fires PM. Jim, why do you think that emerged as our figure of the week from our audience?
Because because it signals the potential end of the one great success from the Arab Spring. Let me just sort of step back, Bob. And what happened was President Kais Saied of Tunisia invoked emergency provisions of the Tunisian constitution to fire the prime minister and to suspend parliament for 30 days. He also imposed a month-long curfew. Now, the president's opponents denounced the move. They called it a coup. They argued that he has abused his powers under the Tunisian constitution and as a result is imperiling Tunisia's democracy. They've asked their supporters to go to the street to protest and make it known that they want to resist what President Saied has done. However, Saied has a lot of supporters in Tunisia. They cheered his action. They look and see a government that, from their point of view, has failed to address the country's many problems, which surging COVID cases has greatly aggravated. Now, Saied's supporters are more concerned about results than process, and they think that if he takes on more power, he can deliver the results that they want. And this is something, Bob, we've talked about a lot. It's happened many other places in the world where people are looking to get results from the government, and they think that a lone individual, unfettered by the constraints of democracy, can deliver a better life more easily and more clearly. I should note that President Saied's move was also cheered in several other Arab countries. The moderate Islamist party known as Ennahda, which is the dominant party in the Tunisian parliament, is despised in places like Cairo, Riyadh, and Abu Dhabi because it is seen as having ties to the Muslim Brotherhood. And the question now becomes, what is going to happen in Tunisia? Is this really only a 30-day pause, or is it truly a coup that is going to see a fundamental change in Tunisia's government? Again, Tunisia was held out as the one great success story of the so-called Arab Spring 10 years ago. You recall that General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi brushed aside Egypt's democratically elected President Mohamed Morsi back in 2013. Libya, Syria, and Yemen were all plunged into civil wars from which they have yet to fully recover. And again, people looked at Tunisia as the success story. And in terms of U.S. foreign policy, this poses a very real challenge to President Biden. Again, Joe Biden, when he became president, said he was going to put democracy and human rights values at the forefront of his foreign policy. Well, here you have a test case. What is the Biden administration going to do? And the challenge in this case, and in many other cases, is that while the United States has high hopes for the success of democracy in other countries, it has few tools with which to really affect things happening on the ground. What happens in Tunisia is going to be driven largely by choices that individual Tunisians make. And so there are a lot of eyes on the Biden administration in terms of what is it going to say and what is it going to do, even as most people in this debate realize that the ability of the United States to influence things on the ground is limited. Again, the United States and many of our allies in Europe clearly want democracy to be restored, are going to be urging Tunisia, President Saied, to make the right choice, but it's not clear that that pressure, whether it is symbolic or becomes substantive, for example, considering issues like cutting off aid or possibly putting people on sanctions, is going to produce the desired outcome.
Jim, I know a few people who have been active in kind of the NGO civil society world, and they were very excited about Tunisia 10 years ago and subsequent years because they saw there, unlike many other countries in the region, an ability and a bit of a flexibility to create the political landscape to actually support parties, including so-called political Islam, so Muslim-dominated parties that would still abide by electoral laws. I've seen in some of the responses to what's lately happened in Tunisia, some cheering from some Gulf autocracies and other places like, haha, political Islam's dead. You know, this is a failed experiment. Is there something in between there that's going on that we don't understand in Tunisia, or is it more sort of more of the trends of the region coming back to form?
Well, I'm not a Tunisia expert, so I have to be very careful here, Bob. I think there are really two broad things happening. One is the divisions within Tunisian society that hamper the ability of the Tunisian government to deliver. And again, this is not unique to Tunisia. Look at American politics today. So there are a lot of people in Tunisia who are unhappy with their government's performance. I think also to an extent, there are countries elsewhere in the Arab world that are doing what they can, sending messages, social media, perhaps through funding and the like, to try to put a spoke in the wheels of Tunisian democracy, precisely because they view Ennahda as a threat to them, right? Because again, in the Arab world, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates are deeply opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood, which was founded back in 1928 in Egypt. They see it as a threat to their form of rule, so they don't want to see it take place elsewhere. And this has been a sort of a long-running fissure in Middle Eastern politics, and you're seeing it play out here in this particular case. And again, it's I think too early to say how Tunisia is going to play out. Tunisians are going to have to make some choices. It's easy to tell a story where they go to the brink and come back. It's also not too hard to tell a story in which they go over the brink. We've seen it happen so many times in so many other countries. This is largely something to be decided by the Tunisians. Others can be on the outside, providing encouragement, urging people on, giving warnings, but it's not clear how much difference that is going to make. Let me put it this way. If making democracy successful were simply a matter of American presidents being supportive, we'd have a lot more democracies around the world.
Point taken, Jim. Thanks. And that's our look at the roiling world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. China celebrates the anniversary of the founding of the People's Liberation Army, and the United States and Russia mark 30 years since the signing of the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not a CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Leila Mahermati, and Michael Kohler for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon. We're going to be on a 1-week hiatus, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Be safe out there.